Okay, so we're going to learn tonight for Refuah Shleima for Rabbi Kelemer, Yehuda ben Rivka, Leah. He should have a complete Refuah. Okay, so we are up to the beginning of Shmos. And it's interesting because I was trying to figure out if I had given a Dvar Torah last year or not during the week of Parsha Shmos. So I went back to sheer enjoyment and went through all my opening Divrei Torah just to like catch a glimpse of it to make sure I wasn't repeating. And I got up to the Chabura and I started off by saying, ugh, I can't believe we're in Shmos. And I can't believe that Bereishis is over. But I have to be honest that I actually am not like heartbroken that Bereishis is over because I think there's some good stuff still in the beginning of Shmos. But yeah, I think we all kind of feel like, oh man, like we're rapidly approaching the end of all of this. But all right, I want to share with you tonight an idea by Rabbi Alex Israel that I think is spot on. He addresses a couple good questions. You know, one question which is I think is a fair one is the role of Medrash in our specific story. But I think he also does something which I think is actually really, really good, and is he tries to analyze the character and the plan of Paro and to try to get us a sense of where Paro is coming from. And I think that one is like, it's a good question because I have always found that it's more interesting to make good people into bad people and bad people into good people. That's been like my bread and butter for 14 years together. But I think the other piece of that is that sometimes with Paro, we'll see the very opening pasuk of our you know, psukim tonight. It's really hard to imagine that Paro went from where Paro was in the times of Yosef to mass genocide. And how that happens, I think, is a really important thing, at least to spend a little bit of time on. So those are the questions. What was Paro's plan? Was he really evil? And what's the role of Medrash in our story? So here we go. A new king came up on Egypt who did not know Yosef. And again, that's the biggest question that everybody struggles with is, what do you mean he didn't know Yosef? You have to imagine that somewhere in Egypt, there must have been a monument of some sort saying Yosef was the one that saved us, and yet all of a sudden he's able to forget him. So I think that's like a question that we have to try to understand. Vayomer lamo, he says to his people, Hinei am b'nei Yisrael rav v'atzu mimenu. The Jewish people are rav v'atzu mimenu. They are greater and more than we are. Now also, what does that mean? Right, like how many Jews were there? Right, we know that at Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is several, at least a couple hundred years later, so you're talking about having 600,000 men. So let's say you say it's 3 million Jews, right? So 3 million Jews was.
Shalu, so 4/5 died. If you want to go with Midrash already.
Okay. So even so,
this is the beginning of the slavery. I mean, we don't know how many there were, and we also don't know how many Egyptians there were.
Right, but it's hard to imagine that at this point, like, is it really true that he says to his people, Am b'nei Yisrael, rava v'tzu mimenu, they're bigger than us? Now, this is an important one, which, by the way, Am k'shei oref is hanging up now on top of right on top of my computer screen because I haven't gotten to it, but it's bothering me. Right, but here Hinei Am b'nei Yisrael. Right, so now that's an interesting question. Maybe we're reading the pasuk wrong. Maybe Rabbi Etshalom would say what he's saying is he's saying El Amo. He's saying to his army Hinei Am b'nei Yisrael Ravatzu Menu. The Jewish army is stronger than us. Now that's a game changer. Except that I think David Barrett's your shape.
The Israel didn't have an army. What is that about?
Right. So the strength of their men, which is what's going to become the, which would be the backbone of their army, he perceives is stronger. Now, is it stronger? Is it not stronger? I don't know. Right? Meaning, like, there is always a psychological component of it, right? You know, like, how many times you hear people say, like, Jews run the world, and there's so many Jews, and then you sit there, you're like, really? There really aren't, right? Like, we're not so many people. And yet, you know, people perceive it that way. So whether it's real or whether it's, that's how he sees it, is a good question. But okay, anyway, what...
The Torah tells us that the land was filled with them. It says,
Right, that's actually two psukim before this, even though on the Makoros, it's in the middle of the page. I went out of order.
Right, so the Torah tells you that the land was full. And as far as the fact that he didn't know Yosef, you know, we always read it like it's an ongoing narrative. It's one long story. But we don't know how much time has elapsed from Yosef's paro to this paro. Could be 100 years.
Right, but you have to imagine that, you know, like, that you forget a lot of people and a lot of things. Yosef's going to be, like, a historical figure. Right, meaning if what Yosef did, right, and we believe that that's true, right, like, Yosef was, like, he completely changed everything in Egypt from the economy, the royal finances. So it's hard to imagine that, like, Yosef was completely forgotten.
Well, it can be, because if you look at all the histories of the you watch on television, every time a new pharaoh came into power, he changed everything. He changed the religion, he changed politics, he literally rechanged the entire thing, and previous was wiped out.
Uh-huh, okay, so...
You talk about one pharaoh to the next, and they're trying to erase the pharaoh before him because they're the new god. They control everything.
Got it. Okay, so that's fascinating. I never heard that, but
I his father's son, there was more coup-like?
It's not specific, but there was... I think there actually was a father and son, that the son was... wanted to go back to the old religion that his father had gone away from, and actually tried to destroy physically every piece of writing his father did to prove that the old religion was right.
Yeah, that did happen, but it didn't happen with every dynasty.
Not everyone, but it could have happened with this one.
Right, so there is, I mean, we did this
A few years ago, Michael, and a few years ago, you talked about the...
right, the Hyksos.
Right.
Right, so that's, I think it's Rabbi Henkin from Israel. That's his, like, that was his, like, theory that Yosef could have been the ruler at the time of the Hyksos, which was a Semitic tribe, and they had been beaten off, and now it's a completely different regime. It's back to, like, the real Egyptians. Yeah, there's no question that that's possible. And then they would want to destroy every remembrance of Yosef.
How many years are we talking about?
How many? So, well, that's actually, it's a great question. Because if I ask you how many years the Jewish people are in Egypt, what are you going to say?
210,
right? Because that's like that's the answer.
Isn't that the slavery number? That's not the whole... Slavery? Years of slavery?
Well, it has to be kind of 400 from, right?
Right, so we're told that we're going to be... We're told that we're going to be slaves in Egypt for 400 years. But most people say we weren't in Egypt for 400 years. Right? Most people say that we were in Egypt for 210 years. Right? And what happened? Right? Redu, right? That's the Gematria. It's like one of the famous, like, Haggadavarts, and we all know it. And we were not there for the full 400 years. If we had been there for 400 years, the Jewish people would have been wiped out. And if you do the math of, you know, let's say Moshe's family of Amram and Kahat Levi, Amram and Kahat, you'll see that, like, they couldn't have been there for that long. 210 years sounds reasonable. But what we're actually going to see in just a little bit is that they might have been there for longer than that, right? It is possible that they were there for longer, and that would, you know, beg the question. But at this point, right, when Moshe is born, that's the last 80 years, which would mean that there's 130, if they were only there for 210 years, 130 years have passed. It is possible that this slavery really only starts in, let's say, I don't know, something like year 100 to 120, something like that, maybe even later. So, yeah, it's a good question that we have to wonder about. Okay, so Paro is nervous. So what does he say? Pasuk Yud, Havanit chak malo, pen yer be, vayaki tikrena milchama, v'nosaf gam hu'al soneinu, v'nulcham banu v'alam in ha'aretz. Let's deal wisely with them. We have to be nervous. Maybe they'll become so big that when there's war, they'll jump on with our enemies and they'll fight us and they'll leave the land. Now, also, what's his real worry there? Now, this is a good one because the Gemara and the Medrash say the v'alam in ha'aretz is actually not really what he meant. Meaning he was saying, halavai, that when they become really strong, they'll leave the land. But his real concern was usually when they... Right, we're going to get kicked out of the land. But that's also, we have to wonder if that's really pshat or not. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayasimu alav saremi sim l'man anoto b'sivotam, vayivin aremis kenot l'paro piton bet Ramses. So they put on them taxes in order to make them suffer, and they build storehouses for Paro, the city of Pitom, and the city of Ramses. Good question, which I did not have the strength to read through the article. It was a little bit more academic. Rabbi Dr. Eli Tzur has a book on geography in the Torah, and he asks the question whether Pitom and Ramses that we have here, who are they referring to? Are they referring to the kings that we're familiar, or the king Ramses that we're familiar with? I didn't get to the answer. The more the Jewish people suffered, the more they became great. And they became disgusted from the Jewish people. All right, so what was plan A? Paro's nervous about the Jews. What's plan A?
Tax and enslave.
Right. Tax them. If you tax them, they're going to work hard. And people that work hard don't necessarily have time. And that's hopefully going to prevent the growth of the Jewish people.
It doesn't seem like a well thought out plan. If you want to create an enemy within your midst, then you tax them and you enslave them. If you want to create a loyal group of subjects who would join your army when the enemy attacks, then you treat them well and have them prosper. So it just seems a bit counterintuitive.
Well, actually, you see, David, I think that's a really good point, right? If you make someone suffer, what might be your goal? Right, meaning you're saying that if you want them to...
Anti-Semitism, but he's not the first anti-Semite, so you
can't... That they will leave.
Right. Neil, that was you?
Yeah.
Sorry, it's hard to follow the boxes. Yeah. That they'll leave. Is that possible? You know, like, I think that we use our own lives. I love the introduction to Covenant and Conversation by Rabbi Sacks in Bereshis, where he talks about how the Parsha guides us through our lives and it guides us through time. And what the Parsha means in one year doesn't necessarily mean the same thing in a different year. But, you know, we often look at Nazi Germany and then we look at this Perek and we draw parallels. And I don't think that that's like an unhealthy thing. I think there are certain similarities. But what was the original intent of some of the things that were going on in Nazi Germany? They weren't necessarily to kill the Jews. They were to rid the Germans of the Jews. The only problem is that nobody wanted the Jews and the Jews were stuck. And that's when, you know, you went to plan B and C and D. But what what starts here is a good question. What was Paro's goal with step A? He puts taxes on them. He makes them work hard. They're building Pitom and Ramses. Maybe Neil's right. Maybe the purpose is they should leave, right? Va'ala min ha'aretz. Rather than having to worry about v'nosafkam hu al soneinu v'nilcham banu, let's skip all that and it'll just be va'ala min ha'aretz. It's a great question. Was that his goal? And again, that was one of our questions that we started off with was, what's Paro's plan? Well, maybe that's possible that that is Paro's plan. Pasuk Yod Gimel. This seems to be the next plan. Plan B. Vayavidu Mitzrayim Ibn Esau Befarech. The Egyptians work the Jewish people Befarech. Right? Befarech could either mean in harsh, back-breaking ways, or Beperach, right, with a soft voice, right? You could convince them to do terrible, you know, to do these things in a soft, devious way, or it could be that you just beat them senseless. Pasuk Yedalet, Vayimarus Chayehem Avoda Kasha, Bechomer Ubilveinim Vechal Avoda Basadeh, Ekol Avodatam Asher Avdu Bahem Mefarech. They made their lives miserable with hard work, brick and mortar, all the work of the field, and all the work that they made them do Befarech. Anybody want to take a stab at maybe what the Mila Mancha is here, what the guiding word is?
Parech, I would assume.
So we have Parech twice. What Shoresh do we have even more of?
Avodah.
Right, Avodah. From Yud Gimel to Ted, Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, we have Avodah five times and Parech twice, which they mean the same thing. Right, it's crushing work. So we could say that we hit the magical number of seven of hard work. Okay, so the second plan, it seems, is make the Jews work super hard. Pasuk Tedvav. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim Lamialdot Ha'ivriot Asher Shem Ha'achat Shifra V'Shem Ha'Sheni Pua. The king of Egypt speaks to the Mialdot Ha'ivriot, the Jewish midwives, who one is named Shifra, the other one's name is Pua. Vayomer bialetchem et ivriot uritem alav naim im benhu vamitemoto vimbati v'chaya. And so he says, when the Jewish women give birth and you see it on the birth stool, right, the kid comes out, if it's a boy, kill it, and if it's a girl, let it live. Vatirena mialdot et alokim, the midwives fear God, v'lo asu kasher diber aleya melech Mitzrayim. They refused to listen to the king of Egypt. But chayena et hayeladim, and they let the kids live.
So this is a multi. These people are having lots and lots and lots of babies. There are teeming throughout the land, and there's two midwives handling all the births.
Yeah, so, yeah. I think we might have done a chabura just on like the question of the mialdot in general. So there's a couple possibilities, right? One possibility is almost like there was a union, right? And Shifra and Pua are the head of the Mialdot. So he speaks to them to pass the message down the line. That's one possibility. One possibility is that they were not Jewish, right? Which is a little bit tough how to read that, right? La Mialdot Ha'ivriot. But you would read it to the midwives of the Jews, right? So that's another possibility. But yeah, probably they were representatives of the people. It's hard to imagine that there were only two midwives for all the Jews. Especially when, in just a moment, we're going to take a look at the famous Rashi of how many Jews there were and how they were born. It just doesn't work. Okay, so Pasuk Yurchet. Vayikra Melech Mitzrayim L'Mialdot. The king of Egypt speaks to the Mialdot. And Vayomer Lehem, Madu Asitem Adavar Hazeh? V'techayena T'yeladim. And they said, he said to them, right, why did you do this? You let the kids live. V'tomarna Mialdot et Paro. The Mialdot answered Paro. Ki lo kenashim ha-mitzviot ha-ivriot ki chayot heina. The Jewish women and the Egyptian are not the same. The Jewish women are more vibrant. And Mitarim Tavole and Amyala de Bialadu. Before we even get there, they've already given birth.
Then why are there these people? They have no job.
Well, David, maybe that's why there are only two of them. Okay. Right? It was not a profitable business. So they're like, we're not doing this. Like, what's the point? Yeah, I don't know. Meaning, like, you have to wonder how much Paro really buys this. But it could be that he's like in a tight spot where he's like, I can't really prove it. This is gonna be a hard one. So what happens? So the God is good to the Mialdot, and the Jewish people are very great in numbers. Because the Mialdot feared God, God makes batim, makes houses for them. Okay. Now, just before we move on from plan C, right? Plan C is kill the Jewish baby boys, but do it in a way that's sort of like quiet.
No one's to blame.
Right. Now, again, it's like going to be a little bit hard to you know, for the Jewish people not to like kind of figure out, like, it's a little weird, but every baby boy seems to be a stillborn. And every girl seems to live. But all right, Paro's trying to do it in such a way.
Is he trying to fool the Jews, or are you trying to fool the other Mitzrayim?
Why?
I'm taking care of our Jewish problem. He doesn't want to say, oh, I'm going to do it by killing innocent babies through the entire population of Egypt, because then maybe he'll turn on them. I'm taking care of it. He's not going to tell him how.
Right. So it's like basically, well, I mean, I guess you could look at that two ways. It's like when someone, I have a kid that comes to me in school all the time. Well, when we're in school, he hasn't shown up at my door yet in the last 2 weeks. Right. But he comes to my office all the time with like these like things that are like so bothering him. And I'm like, I hear you. And I'm like, do you want me to talk to the person? And, like, he goes from, like, 60 to 0. He's like, yeah, it's great. And some of the time, I do get to that, you know, that the people that he needs me to talk to right away. Sometimes it takes me a week to get to them. Because, honestly, I don't think it matters. He's going to be, like, in a, you know, he's going to be all worked up 2 days later anyway about somebody else. So you could say that's, like, Paro is, like, not really addressing it. But he's like, I'm doing it, you see? But I think the other piece is that maybe there is a piece of Paro that realizes that he has to be careful how he deals with it, because if he goes out into the open wanting to kill the Jews, maybe that won't be well received. So he has to wonder about that.
Well received by?
Maybe by his own people. Yeah. So because one of the questions that we did not ask, we asked three questions. What was Paro's plan? Was Paro truly evil? How did Bnei Yisrael multiply the way they did? But there is also a fourth question, which is, how did the Egyptians feel about the Jews? Right, we don't really know. Right, Vayomer Lamo, Pasuk Tet, he says to his people, Hinei Abnei Yisrael, Rav Atzumimenu, the Jews are a lot. He's saying what he feels, right? But we don't know what the Egyptians feel. Were they all in the same boat in this? What do you guys think?
By Pasuk Gut Beis, it's eventually Vaikutsu Bnei Yisrael. I think I'm going to say in plural, but I don't know if that's a general sentiment of the population at that point.
Right. So the question is, what bothered them? What sickened them about the Jewish people? Was it just that they felt like, why is it that we're like in an economic downturn and yet they're doing okay? Why is it that everybody is, you know, the population growth is at a certain percentage and the Jewish people are ahead of the curve? And it shouldn't be, because they're being persecuted, and persecution, one would think, would decrease your numbers, not increase your numbers.
Well, is his people the entire population of Egypt, or is his people the people in the palace?
So that's a good question. That would go, and I know that nobody liked this last week. I felt like my chabura topic was like rejected, but nobody liked the idea of Am being the army. But what if he's talking to his army? Maybe the army has this concern, but like, do the rank and file really care? Like the general Egyptians, I don't know, they're like living on the side of the Nile, doing their thing. All right, maybe like the Jews seem to be like, you know, coming into their neighborhoods and, you know, is that good? I mean, maybe yes, maybe it's, you know, making real estate prices go up, or maybe it's not so good and therefore whatever. I don't know. I'm not sure what the Egyptians feel. And the psukim, I don't think, are clear on that, which is why in a few minutes when we get to the Ramban, we'll see that the Ramban has, I think, something that like he projects on what the Egyptians felt. And it's a question of whether we accept that, whether we're going to accept that Ramban as something that we like and think is accurate, or whether we feel that's not necessarily the case. Okay, so before I move on, the word miyaledet, or, you know, some variation of that, comes through from Yud Zayin to Chaf Aleph also 7 times. So I just think that that's something that we should note. Pazachav Bet, Plan D. Vayitzav Paro l'chol amo le'mor, kol ben ha'yilod ha'yo'or tashlichu v'chol bat techayun. Paro turns to his nation, or his army, if you like it. It does read better here, by the way, as army. I just want to say that. But anyway, Paro commands the people, saying, "Kol ben ha'yilod ha'yo'or tashlichu v'chol bat techayun." Any boy that is born, throw in the yo'or and the Nile, and all the girls should live. Okay, those are our psukim. Plan A, taxes. Plan B, slavery. Plan C, right? Kill all the babies, but do it privately and quietly. Plan D seems like outright genocide, right? Take the babies, rip them from their mothers, toss them in the Nile. All right. So what made this happen, right? What pushes the Jewish people, the Egyptians, to feel this way? So Rabbi Alex Israel suggests a very simple thing. This is cause and effect. If you look at Pasuk Zion, we see what starts it, and therefore it gets everybody nervous, and psychologically they're not in a good place. And so what happens is we have to get the Jewish people out of here. Pasuk Zion, uvnei Yisrael paru vayishrutzu vayirbu vayatzmu b'maod maod v'tmelei artzotam. The Jewish people, paru, they were fruitful, vayishrutzu, and they, whatever, they were crawling all over the place, vayirbu, and they were great in numbers, vayatzmu, they were strong, v'maod maod, very, very much, v'tmelei artzotam, the land was full of them. So Rashi points out, vayishrutzu shayu yoldos shisha b'keres echad. Each woman gave birth to 6 at a time. Now, if the Jewish people each had 6 at a time, their numbers would be pretty great, right? Now, what does that mean? Did they only give birth once? Did they give birth several times? Meaning, like, I don't know. There are definitely people in this, like, in this group that could do the numbers quicker than I can on this. But if 70 families, right, have 6 kids at a time, and not only do they have 6 kids at a time, but they have 3, let's say, we'll call it 3 pregnancies, right? So you're talking about 18 kids. How quick, and this happens for a few generations, right? How quickly are your numbers, like, exploding off the charts? I don't know, like, is it super fast and then the 3 million at Yitzias Mitzrayim doesn't work because it's too small, and then you have to go into the Medrash that Surly said at the beginning of only 4/5 died, right? Or is it that it still doesn't match? Surly, it sounds like you're saying something. What?
Didn't they start with 70? Didn't they start with 70 people?
Yeah, so let's say that's 70 families.
I mean, so it's a lot, you know.
70 people.
Well, 70 men that are married, right? First off, that number is 70, right? We just have to realize there's a little bit of a problem with that number. It's not really the number that went down to Egypt. And the reason why it can't be the number that went down to Egypt is there are only two women that are listed in those 70, right? So did the men not have wives? They did have wives. They weren't all impregnating these same two people, right? So clearly there were at least, let's say you want to say...
They only had two midwives. They only had two women.
Yeah, and one of the midwives was one of those original two women.
Makes it easier.
Right, so you have to assume that the number 70 was, let's say, like the main people. But there were more. There were wives and there were others. But let's say, if we say there were 70 family units.
Yeah, yeah.
So now 70 family units over the course of time, like... In five generations, what would happen?
7 million in 5 generations.
Okay, and what about it? Because Levi was only 3 generations. What would happen in 3 generations?
It's also only half of each group of 6. On average, half of them are women and half are men. So it's 3 and 3 and 3.
Start with the 70. 70 times 18, assuming 3 pregnancies of 6 kids, is 1260.
It's not 18, it's 9. Half of them are men on average.
No, that's the 70. Oh, you're saying they bought... All
right,
but who says they only have 3 pregnancies?
Right? No, I don't know. That's right. That was the.
We're making up the numbers as we go along. But okay.
Let's go with 18 males. And anyway, who says we have 18 males? You'll see it. The numbers grow so fast. Generation 1 is 1260. Generation 2 is 22,600. Generation 3 is 408,000. And the next generation is 7.3 million.
All right, so that's like. That makes you wonder about this medrash on so many different levels. So let's try to figure out what this medrash is talking about and whether there's alternatives that are maybe a little bit more palatable. So the Ibn Ezra says that they didn't have Shisha Bekeres Echad. The women weren't having 6 kids at a time, but they were having twins and many sets of twins, which would make the growth obviously much more. And that we could understand a little bit of where the Egyptians are coming from then, because the Egyptians' big fear was, well, we're growing at this pace because we're having, on average, 1 kid, and they're just having a disproportionate amount of twins. Something must be up. All right, that's one possibility. Shadal, Rav Shlomo David Lutzato, says actually they were there for 430 years. Which actually, I believe, is one of the psukim, right, at Yitzias Mitzrayim, that they were there for 430 years, not 210 years. The Nile made the Jewish people more fertile, or it made all people more fertile. And wait, and Hashem was a big part of this. And I think that that's something that should be noted. It's, yeah, they're there for a long time. It's true. The Nile River helps. But God wanted the Jews to grow at a pace that would outgrow the rest of the population. Rav Meidan, though, has a beautiful suggestion. He says that if you count the generations from Ephraim to Yehoshua, you don't get 3 generations like Levi, where you go from Levi to Moshe to Yitzias Mitzrayim, which is only 3. You have 9 generations. He says, in the 9 generations... If you start off probably with 70 men, but more than that, it's 70 men is the main people that came down, you're going to have growth, but you don't need Shisha Bekeres Echad, right? If you start with 70 families, and he says, if you assume that he does, Shmuel, like you said, point out that you can't assume that everybody are males, right? Half are males and half are females. He goes, with 9 generations and more normal numbers, you can go from 70 families to 1 million people, and it's or 3 million people. It's not so crazy. So he says it's probably, we have to kind of look at that again. But okay, those are our possibilities. The Jewish people grew, says Rabbi Alex Israel, the cause and effect is rapid growth, slavery, plan for Bnei Yisrael, and what happened? What bothered them? The Jewish people broke through, like Henry said earlier, from Goshen, and were now all over the place. The Egyptians were nervous, they were overwhelmed, and they get nervous, and Paro starts with all these suggestions. Das Mikra has a beautiful thought, where he says, you know what the sad part of this whole thing is? There's no greater bracha for a people than Paru Vayishritzu. Right? The idea of Pru Revu, to become a great number, that's the ultimate goal and the dream of any nation. And for the nation to be Mitsuyanim, that they stand out, that's also the very, very greatest bracha a people can have. But it's only a bracha if it happens where? In your land. If it happens in someone else's land, nobody is happy. And that's really the Jewish problem throughout history, is that so much of the success that we have doesn't happen on our land, but it happens outside of our land. And that's what leads to people not being happy with us.
Can I just give you the math real fast as I ran it?
Yeah.
35 males in generation zero, 9 generations with 4 children per generation.
Yeah.
9.1 million.
Really?
Yep.
Not a single death.
Yeah, not a single death, but don't get bad.
No, but that...
No,
but
no, of course there's death. The 35 people died. I'm still left with 140 people. It's not cumulative. I'm taking... Yeah, of course there's death. I have, in the 9th generation, 35 are now 9 million.
All right, there's natural deaths, and then there's the slave...
Right.
Slavery.
Okay, 50%, let's say. It's 50%. Okay. It's still 4.5. It's totally feasible.
Right. Sure. No, the numbers work. Right. I think Rav Meidan comes up with a way of saying that, like, we don't have to go crazy like Rashi, and we can get numbers that really are, like, plausible.
As Mythbusters would say, plausible.
Right. Okay. So where are we at now? We don't have any answers. We still don't understand who Paro is. It's hard to understand where the Egyptians are, and it's hard to understand whether Paro is truly evil. I think we did answer enough about the crazy multiplication of the Jewish people. I personally am more comfortable with Rav Meidan and his way of looking at it necessarily than with Rashi. I like the Ibn Ezra with twins much more than 6 at a time. Rabbi Alex Israel quotes the Sefer... where is it? Here we go. Megale Amukot, a 14th century commentator who talks about in his lifetime there were a lot of women having 4 children. He writes a testimony of a doctor who claims that he met a woman who had 20 children in 4 births. That's what he says. So he says it's not impossible, but it is unlikely, and it's hard to imagine this happening throughout the entire population. Let's take a look at the Ramban, because I think the Ramban will help us a little bit unpack some of our questions. Ramban says, "Havanit chakmalo lo ra paro v'chachme yoatzav lakotam b'charev." He says, why didn't Paro just take out the sword and kill the Jewish people? Right? If you know that the Jewish people are getting to that point, right, where there's a critical mass that will be threatening to you, just kill them now. So ki tiye begida gdola lakot chinam ha'am asher ba'u ba'aretz b'mitzvat ha'melech harishon. The Ramban is saying that Paro was concerned of a civil war by the Egyptians, where the Egyptians would say, Paro, you can't do that to the Jewish people. How do you kill, for no reason, a group of people that were invited down here by your predecessor? He said the people will never accept something of this nature, meaning the Ramban says that we there is a general belief in the goodness of people, and he says society would not allow this to happen. Ki mahemu mityaetz. He's talking to them. Even though he talks to them and says the Egyptians are going, the Egyptians will be overrun by the Jews, nonetheless, the Egyptians would not accept punishing and killing the Jewish people. They couldn't do that to innocent people. Aval amar sheyasu derech chachma shelo yargishu Yisrael ki be'eiva yasu behem. He says, all right, let's just charge them taxes. Shlomo does this also. It's called a work tax. Right? You tell the people you live in the land, you got to work for the land. No big deal. Afterwards, between that and Avdus, the Ramban does not seem to necessarily call it the way we did. I said there were four plans. Plan A was the taxes, and Plan B was Avodah B'Parech. The Ramban seems to maybe think that there's only that that's one and the same. But Achrei Chayin Tzivah V'Seiter L'Mialdot Larog Azcharim Al Avnayim. Then it's privately, he goes to the Mialdot and says, kill the men. V'afil Yoldot Atzmam Lo Yadu Behem. And I'm sorry, and even the Yoldot, the women giving birth, wouldn't even know what happened. And then he says to all the people, you throw the boys and the baby. He does not call in the army, even at the end, in Plan D. He never calls in the army and says, I want you to throw the babies into the Yaor. Aval amar la'am. I know, you can all say, there goes my theory that Am is the army, right? But he says to the people, Kasher yimatzei kol achad yelet yudhi, when you see a Jewish kid, yeshlicho to ba yor, you should throw it into the yor. Why? Because v'im yitzak avia yelet el amelech, if someone comes and protests the injustice of this to the king, o el sara ira to the governor of the city, yom rushi avia dim. He'll say, "Bring me witnesses via sebo nikama, and we'll seek justice." V'kasher hutraret suat amelach hayu amitzim mechapsim abatim v'nichnasim sham b'leilot u'mnakrim u'tzim yeladim misham. But once the king's whip had really like achieved its goal on the Jewish people, what happened at that point in time? Then they actively went looking in house after house. It wasn't just that some fanatical person walked over and saw a Jewish woman with a baby in a carriage, grabbed the baby and threw it into the Nile River. That was how it starts in Pasuk Chaf Bet. But how does it end? It ends with a passionate Egyptian hater who goes and looks for the Jewish baby to throw him into the war, into the water. We're not going to do the rest of the Ramban inside because we're running out of time. But what the Ramban basically builds up is, he builds the psychological path to what it takes to get to genocide. It starts with laws. Those laws turn into discomfort. Discomfort turns into slavery. Slavery turns into laws of murder, but maybe those laws are a little bit quieter. And then eventually it becomes murder out in the open and in the public. According to the Ramban, what?
Does that sound like another genocide that happened to Jews?
Yeah, it sounds exactly like, it sounds like Nazi Germany. No?
Yeah.
Right, so according to the Ramban, what you have is you could actually make the exact parallel. Hitler was always crazy and was always passionate about killing the Jewish people. But Hitler realized that if you went to Plan D first, if the concentration camps were built in 1933 and he tried sending the Jews to the concentration camps, not just some, but all of them, it wouldn't have worked because people can't go from there to there that quickly. So it takes time. And that's what Paro does. That is the Ramban. I want to share with you the Sfarno. I'll share it with you outside. The Sfarno shares something that is completely different. I think Neil said something similar to this at the beginning. Paro wanted the Jews to leave. That's all he wanted. He was not a passionate anti-Semite. He was not some crazy totalitarian dictator. He simply wanted the Jews to leave. So the best way to make the Jews leave is make them uncomfortable. Make it be that they didn't want to stay. He tries. He raises taxes. There's a Jew tax. The Jews are like, fine, we'll pay it. The Jews are enslaved. Fine, we'll be enslaved. Finally, he goes out and says, if you don't have the self-respect, if you don't have the value of your own individuality and your own freedom, I don't care anymore. I don't care. The Egyptians don't care. The Egyptians, if you take a look at the last line of the Makoros, Kishira'u otam evazim atzmam lepu'ula pchuta. Samu otam lavadim. When they saw that they themselves, the Jews, didn't care about them, their own selves, they viewed themselves as worthless. The Egyptians say, fine, if you could choose that path, then what do we care? Then we're done. We're not going to get rid of you. We'll take advantage of the moment and we'll enslave you. I don't know. I'm curious. Whose read do you think is better? The Ramban or the Sfarno?
How different are they?
Well, the Ramban is saying that the ultimate goal was to kill the Jews, but he couldn't start from plan for, at that point. The Sfarno says the exact opposite. He never wanted to kill them. He just wanted them to leave. But when they wouldn't leave, and they kept taking each and every one of these things upon themselves, finally, Paro and the Jew and the Egyptians are like, all right, then we'll enslave you, and if you guys get killed, so be it.
Ramban's shot works much better with the Pesukim.
Why?
Well, better than Sfarno. I mean, Sfarno seems to think at the half of this was not victim blaming exactly, but not victim blaming, and like it just kind of it gradually just led to that point. The Pesukim have it though, as pretty definitive statements. You can divide it into the steps, kind of the way the Ramban laid them out, but it doesn't line up with what Sfarno is laying out there.
So I don't know. I think this Sfarno does work with Pasuk Yod. Right? What is our fear? Our fear is that they're going to take over the land. Right? Right. So what's the best way to get around that? Try to make them leave.
Well, look, like the thing with the Mialdos, right, when they're, not exactly how they're kind of working around them, and they're, like that doesn't speak to a nation that's just kind of like rolling over or...
If he really wanted to kill all the Jews, then wouldn't he have done something else except other than the midwives? The midwives seems to be all right. Let's try and keep them down a little bit, but we're not going to kill all the Jews.
Right. So Neil, you're supporting the Sfarno.
Right.
Right. Because if I don't want to go to that, I just want to get you to leave. So. Your doctors are doing a really bad job and all of them are killing the boys. I don't know, maybe if you try a different area, maybe there's a better hospital in Israel and you won't have all these fatalities.
It works with the Ramban too, with like phase 2 or whatever, 2A, I don't know what it is.
Right. Okay. I'm not sure which one I like more. I probably like the Sfarno a little bit more just because it's different and it's more controversial. But what I think the Ramban and Sfarno do that's really important is that they basically, they observe that there's two possible ways that Gullus could go, Right? Das Mikra makes it clear that you cannot be, that the bracha of being successful is only a bracha in your own land. So the Ramban says, well, there's some kinds of galus where, like, you're there. And there's nothing that you could do to avoid it. It's just how it is. And then, the Ramban, that's the Ramban, right? We're stuck. The Jews can't get out of the land. But the Sfarno, though, is saying that there is actually an alternative type of galus. There's the galus where you can leave, but you opt not to. Where the people are saying, we don't want you here, but there's, you know, the door is open. Just leave. That's the very complicated nature of galus. We don't really know, you know, which one we're in always. But they all happen, and that's the that's really what the history of the Jewish people are full of. Both the Ramban and the Sfarno's version of galus. One thing I did not do, and I'm curious, is whether the Ramban and the Sfarno in their own lives would have been impacted to feel one way versus the other based upon their life experience. But what I did find was, I found that this was a fascinating way to read the Psukim. I'll end on just a personal note. So as I think everybody heard earlier in the week, I did email everyone. God willing, our plan is to make Aliyah at the end of the summer. I do want to clarify one thing. I hope to continue, since we don't have a Chabura live anymore, right? It won't make a difference anymore if we continue to not learn. Well, I shouldn't say we don't have live Chabura, because sometimes we do, but we don't have food at the Chabura anyway right now. So it doesn't really, it doesn't have to be per se by Jeremy. But I hope that we'll be able to continue to learn next year. Zoom is a good friend of ours, or, you know, to some extent at least it will allow it. And I get up really early in the morning anyway. So like 4 a.m. is 9 o'clock at night. Like I do hope that the Chabura can continue, because one of my thoughts all these years was if I ever made Aliyah, I couldn't imagine the Chabura, like losing the Chabura. But once we lost the food from Jeremy, the Chabura anyway kind of changed a little bit. So I hope that we'll have the opportunity to continue to learn. But in the emails and the texts I got for the last couple days, I got one from Rebbetzin Hochberg yesterday that I thought really captured the essence of the Sfarno. She said, you know, that she's super happy for us and we should be, you know, matzliach, etc., etc. And she said the one thing that she wonders is, in a generation from now, not our generation, but the next generation, right? Are they going to ask the question, why did we not leave America when we could have? Not that we're going to be stuck here, not that there's going to be a Holocaust or whatever, but why didn't we, you know, take the opportunity? And I think that's what the Sfarno is saying. The Sfarno is saying is that you didn't have to be there. You had the opportunity to leave. And that's the mistake that the Jewish people make in Egypt. And that's what's wild about the Sfarno. Because the Sfarno leaves it that if the Jewish people had the self-respect to realize that they were being treated in a way that was improper and poor, and they would have walked out, the Shibud would have been over before it even started. And that's a pretty crazy idea. Because the Sfarno is basically saying, Paro wasn't a bad guy. The Egyptians didn't hate the Jews. It was the Jewish people. And I know, Shmuel, victim blaming does not sound very comfortable on this one. But that seems to be, I think, the heart of what the Sfarno is saying.
What about the Brisbane of Sarn? It was a promise to Avram that they're going to be enslaved and they're going to be tortured.
But what's slavery? Slavery is galus. What does galus mean, right? Meaning, like, we're...
Gam is a goy, Asher Yavod Dugan Anochi, and that nation is going to be punished? I mean, that's more than just being in galus.
But what, you know, it's interesting because I think you could look at the Egyptian galus and you could look at the initial Egyptian galus and say, you know, like the end of it sounds a whole lot. And the Ramban sounds a whole lot like Nazi Germany, right? But someone asked, maybe it was David that asked, what's the time frame of this? They were there for 100 years before any of this began. Is it possible that the beginning of the Galus was Vatimaleya Aretzotam? It was more of an American or even the pre-Nazi Germany Galus, where the Jewish people were doing it to themselves, right? Assimilation was what was hitting them. Could that be part of Bris Bein Habsarim? You're going to go down to Egypt. You're going to become, you know, part of their culture. It's not going to be home. But then you have the opportunity to leave. Again, it sounds like the...
They still have the Arameo Shana from that point in time.
But they're not their Arameo Shana anyway.
Okay, but you have this whole... You have this prophecy that was very well known. That was passed down from generation to generation. How do you reconcile the two?
Rav Soloveitchik says that the Jewish people, if not for Mechiras Yosef, the Bris Bein Habsarim could have been the 20 years by Lavan. He says what does the number mean? The number it could be Lashon Guzma. It's like an exaggeration. You're gonna be there for a really long time. For Yaakov, for his kids, that was a long time. And all the things that happened in Egypt, macro, happened micro there. So why does it have to be...
And how was Lavan punished? Where was Lavan's big punishment that God punished?
Yeah, he's told off by God at the on Galeed. And he runs away. He runs for 7 days. I mean, the Paro Lavan... not imagery, the language, it's the same. Why is it there? Because it could have been.
But if you're saying that could have been the whole Galus, that was over and finished before Yosef was sold, huh?
Yeah, if not for Mechiras Yosef, if the brothers could have just gotten along, all that could have been so different.
Okay.
Wild stuff. All right.